following is a discussion of Western propaganda by several journalists. Instead of the news this morning, you are responsible for this following reading for the test.
The music of seething passivity. If I could only have known that Mick would one day become a pop star of the first magnitude, I would have paid more attention to him on that occasion in Geneva. I was introduced to him by a journalist friend of mine from the music section of Elie. Our interview was short. I just asked three questions. Whether he thought his art was real, whether it seemed to him that there were too many like him, and that he had been luckier than others, and whether he thought that in 2 or 3 years' time he would be forgotten. The answer to the first two questions was laconic, yes and no. To the third question, he replied in more detail. He said it was far better to be forgotten than to be a civil servant awaiting the death of his boss with impatience to take his place. He added that he hated journalists. That was about 10 years ago. Since then, interviewing Mick Jagger has become as easy as shaking hands with a panther. He still hates journalists, and his bodyguards keep a watchful eye over the peace and quiet of the superstar. In 1976, Mick Jagger and four of his pop music colleagues toured 9 Western European countries. They were accompanied by a service team 100 strong. It took 13 lorries to carry the group's belongings, including Mick Jagger's own wardrobe, estimated at 250,000 francs, and 18 electric guitars belonging to Keith Richards. Needless to say, the maintenance costs of the Magnificent Five were more than justified. In London alone, over 1.5 million requests were made for their concert. Mick has long since been a millionaire, and he does not conceal his satisfaction. He is now rich enough to indulge in every whim. Some years ago, he had an emerald put into one of his teeth. He later replaced it with a ruby and finally with a diamond. Now, by his own admission, everything is okay. The Rolling Stones are now a legend. Books are written about them, and films are made. And yet, their beginnings were quite ordinary. Mick Jagger, Keith Richards, Brian Jones, Charlie Watts, and Bill Wyman, who at the time were under 20, were sons of school teachers, a building worker, a driver, and an engineer. Formed a group and began playing on Sundays in a London restaurant. Mick sang, Keith strummed his guitar, Bill tried his hand on drums. It was in those years that the Beatles started out on their career in Liverpool. But while the latter were well-groomed and decently dressed, Mick Jagger and his friends shocked their audiences with their disheveled hair and dirty clothes. Scandalous publicity is also a form of publicity. The group's motto was, the Stones are those who are hated by parents. In other words, in the Rolling Stones, the music world had an upended version of the Beatles. Official Britain was profoundly shocked. One of London's colleagues expelled several of its students for their Rolling Stones hairstyle. Colleagues and universities elsewhere in Britain introduced regulations which said that Beatles' haircut was decent, was in with society, while a Rolling Stones hairstyle was out, rejected by society. Things were made worse by the fact that the lyrics of the Rolling Stones songs centered around drugs, alcohol, and sex. In fact, one of the group's members, guitarist Brian Jones, died of an LSD overdose. By the mid-60s, the Rolling Stones songs began to sound the theme of rebellion and later of revolution. True, they did not specify just how either should be brought about. They just called for the destruction of the old world, and that was that. The Stones are with us, I was told by one of the students involved in the student rioting of May 1968 in Paris, they're spitting in the ugly face of capital. Thus, the Rolling Stones found themselves in the mainstream of the youth protest movement. Singing their songs, the students of the West rose in spontaneous rebellion against the establishment mentality. As a result, the charm and charisma of the Beatles could not compete with the aggressiveness of the angry children, aggressiveness of the noisy and shouting variety, but also fruitless and non-dangerous. Mick Jagger once declared aggressiveness and violence to be stronger than politics, because politicians are incapable of changing anything in this world. The Rolling Stones identify inept and fruitless politicians, of whom there are indeed quite a few, with political figures and politics in general, and this way set hundreds of thousands of their fans against all political and social activity. The Rolling Stones followers identify with them, with their non-involvement in politics, and at the same time, they identify with their contempt for factory work or office work and for work per se. And although most of the Stones fans can hardly afford to copy their idols and stop working, they do find satisfaction in their verbal ravings and rantings against bourgeoisie values. Stupefied by the rock rhythms, they pay no attention to the fact that their idol, Mick Jagger, while protesting against the consumer society, is flashing his diamond-studded teeth, that his shocking suits are made of some of Europe's most expensive tailors, and that the best hairdressers spend hours creating his disheveled coiffure. They don't, but those whom Mick Jagger is overthrowing certainly do. They have long stopped looking upon the Rolling Stones as out. They have been lavishing upon them the sort of publicity which even those of the top artists whom they have put into the in category rarely qualify for. In the hands of Western propaganda wizards, Mick Jagger and his brethren have become a peculiar myth which attracts the imagination of young people like a magnet, and which demoralizes their creative energies, diverting them into an abstract and hence safe protest. There is no denying that some of the Rolling Stones songs do have a definite social thrust. They do aim at the moral values of the square bourgeoisie society and call for emancipation of the individual from sexual taboos established by bourgeoisie law. Only this kind of protest does not threaten the pillars of the Western world. The Western world is not afraid of a physical assemblage of free individuals. What it does fear is the unification of individuals into a revolutionary force. The attitude of the Western world to the anarchist movement of young men free from all kinds of taboos, the hippie movement, is the best proof of this. Realizing the harmless nature of this kind of emancipation, Western ideologists began to encourage the movement for personal sexual freedom, permissiveness, or personal freedom in the field of protest art. And although T. Rozak, the idealist of the New Left, claims that the youth counterculture is an implacable opponent of the traditional bourgeoisie culture, the latter, in fact, manipulates the former and swallows it up. And youth opposition itself thus becomes a marketable commodity on the market of bourgeoisie values. Aren't you Soviet journalists hooked on finding an ideological meaning everywhere? It's absurd. Do you really think that the Rolling Stones divert their fans and are themselves almost in politics? I think they could not care less for politics. They just do what they feel like doing. They play, they sing, they dance. Giles Dumas was angry. I have never seen him so angry before. A student, a member of the Progressive Political Organization, he hated capitalism and loved the Rolling Stones. We did not come to any agreement on the subject of the Rolling Stones, but during our argument, I had to listen to his lecture about my vulgarized illusions. Having had his say, Giles calmed down a bit and concluded in a conciliatory tone, "Perhaps I'm wrong somewhere, but why don't you go and see for yourself how young people react to the Stones? Seeing is believing. Go and see them in action." Easier said than done. It was next to impossible to get tickets for their concert. After a colossal effort, I managed to get one. Even at the entrance to the hall, which looked and sounded like a raging human sea, one could say with confidence that the live concert's success was assured. Inside the hall itself, the atmosphere was full of general excitement. Electrified, one felt a thunderstorm was in the offing. Then for a brief moment, everything was quiet. Suddenly, the silence was exploded by the thunderous applause that greeted the entry of the Stones. I recalled stories about one of their live concerts during which the overexcited audience began to wreck chairs and everything else in the hall. The ensuing melee claimed the lives of several fans. Dozens were injured. But on this occasion, mercifully, the concert passed off without casualties. I would like to sketch what I saw. Mick Jagger was twisting and writhing on stage like a cobra. They say that he loses 3 kilos in every concert. His suits with their green, red, and violet scales were shining in the spotlights. And all the while, he kept up a non-stop torrent of obscenity, abused what he called the serving public, accompanying the whole performance with indecent gestures and manipulating his doubtful accessories. I had often witnessed how African tribesmen worked themselves up into a frenzy in the ritual dance to the sound of tom-toms. Compared to the Rolling Stone fans, they looked like children. Two girls of about 16, sitting next to me, were screaming shrilly for all they were worth. I don't know the natural color of their eyes, but at that moment they were quite white. I doubt if they saw anything except perhaps their idol, Mick Jagger. In the state they were in, they could hardly hear the lyrics, nor the music. They must have felt like rabbits mesmerized by the hypnotizing eyes of a boa constrictor. As for me, sitting next to them, I felt ill at ease, like a teetotaler at a table with a bunch of alcoholics. When the concert was over, I was still unconvinced and kept to my former opinion. Although I must admit some of their numbers appealed to me, as did some of the songs by the Beatles and other pop groups. In fact, some of these pop songs carried a message of dedicated struggle. Songs like Power to the People, Angela, and the working class hero of John Lennon. The same Lennon was reported to have contributed a large sum of money to the strike fund of the Upper Clyde shipyards. And yet, the personal aspirations and thoughts of the pop musicians changed nothing in the general situation, where bourgeoisie ideology and culture have swallowed up the Beatles, the Rolling Stones, and other pop groups. And the phenomenon of pop music itself has become a powerful tool for confusing the younger generation. The Rolling Stones songs carry no meaningful message. They appeal to instincts, the same irrational instincts which are an easy target for the yellow press, describing violence, sadism, and all manners of sexual perversions. For pop music, just like the Black Series novels, gradually accustoms its addicts to a mindless attitude to life. By exciting reflexes, it dulls the mind, and its fans eventually develop a definite pattern of thinking, pop mentality. The musical creativity of the Rolling Stones is confined to inventing way-out sound combinations. When Mick Jagger was once asked what message his music sent to the audience, he replied with characteristic heavy-handed humor that whenever he wanted to send a message, he usually went to the nearest post office. Not surprisingly, his fans come away from his concerts with their heads as empty and as ringing as Bill Wyman's drums. Social environment, which creates the ultra-modern human being, includes art as one of its organic ingredients. Under the impact of art, the aesthetic senses of man are developed as the centers in his brain, which control his perception of the beautiful. At live concerts given by the Rolling Stones, contorted faces and twisting bodies make one thing clear, that certain forms of modern arts are quite capable of destroying the human in people and reviving long-forgotten animal instincts in men and women, which may reduce consciousness to the level of reflexes. And whatever Giles Drummer may say to the contrary, here, this does play into the hands of social propaganda, which theoreticians have been recently careful to draw a line of distinction between political slogans and practical activity. They're not concerned about declarations and protests. However, radical sounding, as long as these are not matched by action. Jacques Ellul has defined this phenomenon as orthopraxy, as distinct from orthodoxy, where, according to Ellul, actions correspond to convictions and spring from them. And he considers this phenomenon as a major characteristic of today's Western propaganda. According to Ellul, what is important is not so much to change the individual's convictions by intellectual means and convince him to accept a new doctrine, but rather through emotional influence to involve him in an active process. The important thing is to excite his reflexes rather than offer him a choice. Elements of this line of reasoning could be found in Goebbels' theoretical explorations. Goebbels identified two basic ingredients in propaganda: Haltung, behavior, and Stimmung, morals, and opted for the former without hesitation. In this propaganda mechanism, action, no longer a logical result of thinking, choice, or decision, is a reflex. The individual so affected may even have political convictions, but he acts contrary to them. Not long ago, a sociological poll was conducted among France's young people with the subject, "What do you think of the future and your own part in it?" Many young people replied that the future belonged to socialism. As for their personal participation in that future, some of the answers described plans of finding employment, of marriage, and of achieving material security. What they did not mention was their personal participation in the struggle to establish the new social system. The ruling class in the West has no objection against this kind of abstract socialism, which will be handed to the young on a silver platter, someday, somehow. In this sense, the revolutionary Rolling Stones are a godsend for Western propagandists. The Stones make a lot of harmless noise, a noise that does not rock the pillars of society and merely tickles the nerves. Their verbal attacks on the bourgeoisie system and their denunciation of politics do not rule out the fact that they themselves unwittingly help others to make a quite definite social policy and implement it. The Rolling Stones' spit in the ugly face of capitalism is a tiny speck of the fashionable rebellion against the highbrow academic culture, which they identify with the elite, exalted spheres of society. But along with the anti-democratic barrenness of this elitist culture, the pop rebellion destroys real culture. As a result, mass counterculture, deprived of any ideas, is just as dead as the elitist culture they criticize, which leaves the masses separated from thinking and rational perception. The music of the Rolling Stones, despite its aggressiveness and screaming sound, encourages passive attitudes. Just because this passivity is noisy, it does not become less passive. This is seething passivity, if you like. An interesting sidelight. The noisy advance publicity that had preceded the Rolling Stones live concerts in Paris and the concerts themselves coincided with the decision of the French authorities to shut down the Paris Opera House because it was losing money. This decision was later reversed following a storm of protest by the French artistic community. No doubt this coincidence is accidental, but the trend is clearly defined and logical. According to official figures between 1968 and 1975, an estimated 33% of professional actors and actresses lost their jobs. I once interviewed a jobless actor who complained that the mass of the French theatergoers do not know the difference between real art and its substitute, that their cultural standards are dismally low. True, he qualified his complaint by saying that he had attended the La Humanite Festival and was impressed by the genuine interest with which the young people listened to Grand Messe des Mortes by Berlioz. To be sure, it is not a question of the public. It is perfectly possible to improve the standards of musical culture among young people by encouraging them to visit concert halls. But for this to be a realistic proposition, several things must be done. A large network of concert halls must be set up, the price of tickets cut, and wide publicity and promotion of the great works of music and musicians must be organized. So far, however, this is an empty dream, for France's Ministry of Culture gets a meager 0.5% of the state budget. It is surprising, then, that 78% of Frenchmen between the ages of 15 and 26 have never been to a single concert of classical music. Their introduction to serious music is limited to listening to records and tape recordings, and they are produced entirely by private companies whose aim is to make a quick profit and keep on doing so. They find it far more profitable and easier to satisfy primitive musical taste than to educate the public's musical taste in the spirit of altruism, which would give a low return on investment. And as a result, the French music market is swamped with American pop songs. To popularize and promote this music, vast amounts of money are spent. By contrast, pitiful sums are allocated from the ministry and culture's meager budget to support composers and performers who draw on the best in national and international classical tradition. In this instance, the pursuit of maximum profits by the monopolies fully fits in with their ideological interest, the desire to sell culture to the maximum number of people inevitably leads to a leveling out of cultural standards, to a mediocre average, to a form of cultural conformism. But conformism is in culture goes hand in hand with political conformism, which is also inculcated at an early age. Hit Podium and Others. I have before me the Paris magazine Hit, Podium, and Salut les Copains. Let's scan their pages. Salut les Copains announces a super quiz with 5 free tours to the Philippines, California, and Senegal for the winners. There are attractive prizes for runner-ups, trendy clothing, stereo systems, electric guitars, records, Polaroid sunglasses, etc. The questions, the magazine says, requires no special knowledge. Here is a sampling. Pop star Sheila opened several shops selling ready-to-wear apparel. When was this? France Gall is well known to the folk on the island where she always spends her holidays. Can you say in what village she resides? You all know the young charming singer Leslie, but do you know the name of her pet dog and its breed? To answer these questions, one does not have to be a Solomon. It's enough to be a regular subscriber to Salute de Les Copains themes, or to Hit or Podium, which organize similar quizzes. If you score the right answer, you can identify with your idol, not only vicariously, but in the flesh, as it were. For instance, Helene Grenier of Louaine par Vaubrette won Muriel Matthews for Coat. Edith from Treyport won a Rolls Royce, a carbon copy of the Rolling Stones star Mick Jagger's car. Or Daniel from Andelot in Montaigne, whose prize was a motorbike like Johnny Halliday's. Sylvie Vartan is of the ordinary working class stock, while Michael Delpech was once a farm boy. Hit devotes 3 full pages to a description of Ferrey St. Cyr, the village where Delpech grew up. We see the idol with his father and grandfather, feet astride a furrow. Their wrinkled faces and horny hands are those of a true farmer. Thus, even if you are a young worker or farmer, don't lose hope. Of course, only 4% of France's student body are from working class or farmers' families, yet the magazines give the impression that they can make up for those in music with a vengeance. Just as celebrated guitarist and singer Mike Brant did, not so long ago, Podium tells us Mike was an ordinary garage mechanic. And today, we are treated to a series of photographs. In 1970, he was a simple boy. In 1971, he had his first big concert and first big hit. The year of 1972 brought his first television appearance. In 1973, he signed a contract with Polydor. In 1974, he already held the top symbol of success, the golden disc. Why necessarily Mike? Why not Jean or Jean? After all, neither Mike nor she yet have unique voices. It certainly seems worthwhile to try one's luck in the Everybody Sings radio contest. True, thousands take part and only a few make it to the top. Not even 1 out of 1,000. But some do, even when still quite young, like Canadian Renee Simard, for whom critics predicted an Elvis Presley career after his spectacular success at the Olympia Music Hall at the tender age of 12. A millionaire today who has toured many countries. Is there really any difference between him and other boys and girls of his age? He does his homework, plays hockey, and adores ice cream. He's just lucky, that's all. A lottery, of course. But why not take a chance? Of course, you have to be patient. Don't get depressed if success doesn't come overnight. Just bide your time and keep smiling. A case in point is another idol, Dave. Hit tells a touching story of this Dutch boy who came to Paris with empty pockets, but with a guitar and never say die spirit. In a 1966 snapshot, we see Dave playing his guitar on Place de la Contrescarpe, with cap held out to cafe patrons. In another photo taken in 1975, we see him at a table in that same cafe, in that same square, as unknown English boy strums his guitar in front of him. Recalling his own story, Dave presses a coin into the strolling musician's hand. The magazine comments,